right, next on the schedule is Anup Wenatharanarat. We'll be speaking about a three-dimensional core collapse supernova model resembling CASA. Very good. And Anup, I'll be giving you a five-minute warning.
Yeah, thank you. So thank you to the organizer for giving me the opportunity to speak here today. And today I speak about our attempt to perform 3D core collapse supernova simulations. Connecting the supernova phase to the supernova remnant, and in particular, one of the model has a morphology of the heavy elements resembling the ones that we see in Cassiopeia. So, needless to say that we put a bunch of physics into our complicated 3D supernova models, and we would like to put the models to test. So we have to generate these observables, and except for the neutrinos and gravitational wave, which carry away message directly from the engine to the observer, the other observables, we need to evolve the models until late time, at least until the shock breakout, to get these messages. So what we have been trying to do is to perform the long-time simulation starting from the 1D stellar evolution model, be evolved through the collapse and bounce, still in 1D by Thomas Ettel and then another postdoc in our group in Garching. And at about 15 milliseconds after bounce, we map the model to a 3D grid, and we explore them in 3D and evolve until the shock propagates through the onion skin layers in the star until about one day after the explosion. And at that stage, we again map to 1D to analyze for the light curve. Victor Drobin with his crab code does the bolometric light curve analysis. And also Sasha Kosirova, who is now at MPA, analyzes the multi-band light curve, but still in 1D with the stellar code. And we also try to push the models to much later time, years after the explosion, and Michael Gabler was responsible for that. And he managed to already evolve some of the models, four models, I think, until about 20 years after the explosion. Although we start to collaborate with Dennis Alp and Anders Jastrand for the X-ray and gamma ray light curve and line profiles analysis. So how do we manage to explore the so many 3D models? So the study we are doing is a parameterized 3D model. And I would just like to mention that in this parameterized 3D setup, we excise the innermost 1.1 solar mass core of the protoneutron star and replace it by a point mass, which is also acts as a neutrino source. We impose the neutrino luminosity at the inner boundary, which is contracting, mimicking the contraction of the protoneutron star. And we solve the neutrino radiation transport in a gray approximation with the ray by ray, in a ray by ray manner. And by cutting out this inner part, it speeds up the simulation, becomes feasible, much more feasible. So one run from the early phase, 15 millisecond after bounce until the end, costs will cost roughly about 60,000 CPU hours. So these are the list of the progenitor models that we have considered so far. The first two are 15 solar masses, rare supergiant stars, and the rest are progenitors tailored especially for the supernova 1987A. So this one is 20 solar mass Shigeyama and Nomoto. This one is the old 15 solar mass from Stan Woosley. These are a bunch of 16 to 18 solar masses from the Stan Woosley. These are single star models, and the bottom part is the new binary merger models by Menon and Hager. And the first two digits are the mass of the primary, and the second part is the mass of the secondary. And yeah, for the past 9 years or so, we have already simulated several tens, about 70 explosion models in 3D from this list, and I think the number will likely to be growing pretty fast in the next few years as well. Just to give you an idea what's going on in the simulation, this is from the red supergiant model, the 15 solar mass. You get this heating from neutrinos from below, which drives this convective instabilities. And once the shock gets enough energy, it expands, continue the expansion into the onion skin layers. And the shock dynamics later will follow roughly the blast wave solution. So whenever you get this quantity rho r cube, the decreasing rho r cube, you will get an acceleration of the shock. And that is shown by this plot here. This y-axis is the shock velocity, this is the radius, and the dotted line here is the rho r cube profile. And you see that at the composition interface, you get this decreasing rho r cube and the shock accelerates. And after that, follows by the deceleration of the supernova shock. And this plot is for example for red supergiant model. This is for a blue supergiant star. And because of this non-monotonicity in the shock propagation through the different layers in the star, you get this Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities in some of the layers. This is a 1D simulation showing the density profile versus radius at different times by Konstantinos Kifonidis. And I would like to point out here, for example, that for example, between this 20 second and 300 seconds, you see the shock acceleration, and that creates this negative density profile, and the shock later decelerates, which drives the pressure wave backward, and you have this positive density gradient. And in this region where the gradient of the density and pressure is opposite, then you get the growth of this Rayleigh-Taylor instability. And I just play the movie again. So in this movie, you see how the initial asymmetry, these convective bubbles evolve over time. When you get this growth of the RTIs, the bubbles, the initial large scale bubble will tend to fragment or reduce in angular size. And there you get the final morphology of the initial asymmetry. So we are now moving to one particular model, this W15-2, which I showed you the movie before. And we notice that in this model, the morphology of the nickel-rich ejecta resembles very much the ones that you see in Cas A. Mainly you see these three big blobs of the nickel rich ejecta. So we try to see that what if we don't have this hydrogen rich envelope on top of this nickel rich bubbles. And we do that by just artificially stripping the hydrogen-rich shell from this red supergiant star, and then we evolve the model longer, and this is the final nickel, the morphology of the nickel-rich ejecta that we get at the end of the simulation. And to compare with the iron ejecta, the shocked iron ejecta in cast A, you see this 1, 2, 3 blobs, and the morphology looks very much like that in cast A. And just to give you a more a better idea of the morphology of the nickel and also titanium in our model, I have this interactive 3D figure, which you can also find at these two URL. And then we would like to also compare with the observations, and they have this 3D interactive figure at the Smithsonian 3D. So I just go out. Okay. So on the left, you see our model. This is showing the titanium distribution. Yeah, thank you. And on the right, you see the model from the Smithsonian 3D. And yeah, you can rotate this model around, and you see that these three fingers aligned, forming a thick disc like ejecta, as in the ejecta of Cas A here. So you can play with the models later. Okay. And if we also rotate the model around and aligned our neutron star kick direction in this model with the one that we see in Cas A, you see that the kick direction is roughly opposite to the direction of where most of the nickel and titanium rich ejecta is moving to. And why is that? Well, we can understand by considering the neutron star kick mechanism due to the gravitational tugboat mechanism, the name which goes back to Jeremiah Murphy. He suggested that a few some time ago. And in this kick mechanism, it's just the slowest moving ejecta at early time. Like in this plot, you see the gray sphere is the neutron star, and you see clear asymmetry inside the ejecta. And this slow ejecta pull this neutron star along with the gravitational drag force. And I plot here the neutron star acceleration as a function of time. And you see that the total acceleration, the black line here, is dominated by the gravitational drag term. And because on this side, the ejecta expands more slowly. On the opposite side, the expansion is faster, so the explosion strength is faster, and there you synthesize more efficiently the heavy elements. That's why you see this anti-correlation between the most of the heavy elements and the direction of the kick. And also in 2007, Thomas coined the relation between the kick the kick magnitude to the explosion properties, and in this formula you can understand it easily by considering that the neutron star kick velocity is proportional to the explosion energy times this kinetic energy fraction, which gives you sort of the momentum budget. And this alpha parameter is the momentum asymmetry parameter. And that tells you how asymmetric the explosion is. And of course, it depends on the mass of the neutron star. So since I don't have much time left, I would like to also mention that we, in 2013, we published already some models, and we see the kicks of several hundred kilometers a second and the spins ranging from the 100 millisecond to several seconds, and we are expanding the set of models in another publication, and we see no spin kick alignment. And this kick mechanism seems to be supported by the analysis by Satoru Katsuda here in these six young remnants. And yeah, I would like to mention also that maybe you can see the talk by Tyler on Friday in more details about the asymmetry that you see in Cas A. And I have to skip these two slides. Okay, so in conclusion, we performed 3D simulations of cochlear supernova from shortly after the bounce until the shock breakout. And we see that the morphology of the titanium and the nickel-rich ejecta resembles very much the ones that we see in Cas A. And yeah, especially the neutron star kick direction is roughly opposite to the direction of the heavy element. And that is due to the kick by the gravitational tugboat mechanism. And one last conclusion is that I think it's now feasible to perform the large set of 3D simulations, and it will be exciting to connect these models to the remnant phase. Thank you.
Okay, time for questions, please. Right. Right there.
So I can see the similarity in the general location of these concentrations of the ejecta, but I don't see any small-scale clumping. Is there any in there, or formation of these sort of bubbles?
So the morphology of the nickel-rich ejecta that you see at late time came from this initial asymmetry that I showed in this movie, this convective bubbles, and it grows. We put in random perturbations, and it grows naturally, and that evolved over time due to this Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities in different layers. And so I don't think I quite.
If you look at Cas A right now, they have these very small clumps of ejecta, and also these ring and shapes, which I don't see in what your results.
Okay. So we have this mainly three big blobs of the nickel, but this is still the model at one day. So we have to continue the model and see how the reverse shock, when the forward shock slows down in the interaction with the CSM, how the reverse shock will crush these models and fragment this model, this nickel blob, the large blobs, into smaller scale structures. So we will have to run the model longer to see that.
Time for one more question, and sorry, Steve, I'm going to go over here. Over here, please put your hand up. Pass the microphone.
So I'm curious about the importance of shock acceleration. So you showed when rho r cubed is declining, then the shock accelerates. So this is indeed the case, but the way that it goes about is because the shock is causally disconnected from the energy behind it. So while the shock might be accelerating forward, most of the energy keeps going at the same velocity. So how does it help you that the shock accelerates? I'm trying to understand the dynamical importance of the shock acceleration.
So the shock dynamics follow this blast wave solution only when you don't get large contribution from the inner energy, so the energy source from the neutrinos becomes less significant already.
Right, but most of the energy keeps going at the same velocity, even though the shock is accelerating. Right, because the way that it goes, right, when you have these solutions of an accelerating shock, then most of the energy is left behind, as opposed to the case when the shock is decelerating and most of the energy is close to the shock front. It's a different kind of solution. Most of the energy is behind. If you do the calculation right, for an accelerating shock, the only way that you can accelerate is if you leave most of the energy behind.
Yeah, but you get the acceleration only at the interface, and then you get the deceleration later.
Okay. I'm going to pause the discussion. Perhaps we can take this towards a coffee break just to keep on schedule.
Thank you
for your question. We'll discuss afterwards. Let's thank Anup again very much.